Blog Talk Radio.
I'm looking for a reason, roaming through the night to find my place in this world, my place in this world.
Welcome to Wake Up to Purpose with your host, John Stanko. This program will help you find your purpose and, more importantly, how to make your purpose work for you. And now, here's John Stanko.
Well, hello out there in internet radio land. John Stanko, your host for Wake Up to Purpose. And I want to welcome you back to another show today in the second week of my revived show. It took a few years off, but it's good to be back, but I'm certainly not happy with the circumstances that brought this about. But I trust you are making the most of it and the best of it, as I have been encouraging my viewers and my followers and my friends on social media. I talked to a friend in Kenya this morning, and just very distressing what she reported. She's in Nairobi, and the city of Nairobi, 6 million people plus, is locked down. Nobody can get in and get out, and the police are enforcing it very strictly. And I think she said there are a couple other counties that also, there are 50-some counties in Kenya, but she quoted to me that about 2.5 million people have access to resources, you know, to get food, but the vast majority of the 40 million people do not, and there's no place to go. They have no money to purchase food with, because they live on a day-to-day basis, both getting paid and shopping. Very often, we go to rural areas, you'll see somebody with a motorcycle, and that's Uber. That's what they drive people with, so they get paid to do that, and then that's how they live on a daily basis. So she also said there is no government plan, there's no government proposal, there has been reduction of taxes on companies, but the companies aren't making any money, so it's kind of a hollow benefit. And so, you know, it just causes me to think, and I know we have issues here in the United States, but we're on the other end of the spectrum where, you know, we're arguing over how much to do, and then we have some of the world that really isn't doing much of anything and can't really do much of anything. But she did share that she felt the leadership was being rather self-centered. I won't say any more of that, because I hate to say that, because it paints those folks in a bad light, and they're wonderful people. But some of the leaders, when they do get positions of power, do look for it as an opportunity to make the most of it for themselves. And so, you know, she was very concerned, and we are too, and have had a fundraiser going for our orphanages, we have one pastor who cares for 72 orphans, 18 of them are high school age, and they're usually away at school, but of course the schools are closed, and now they're home, and there's no way they can social distance. They're, you know, all staying in dormitories, and so anyway, that's part of the concern that I carry. But anyway, we have a really special guest today. Janice Kelsey is waiting in the wings, is on hold, and we're going to bring her in. Janice wrote a book, I Woke Up With My Mind on Freedom, has a really interesting story of a time in my own country's history that was not so happy and not so pleasant to look at, But Janice and many others like her played a key role in bringing our nation to its senses, and continue to do that by not allowing us to forget and calling us to be the people that we claim to be as a nation. So Janice will be joining us in just a moment, as is our custom on both my Facebook Live and this show and anything else I happen to be doing. During this season, we are reading Psalm 91, and this is not something we read from a distance, so to speak. This is not something that we're looking back at the psalmist's experience and thinking, oh, he was going through a tough time. This is what we're bringing forward to live in today. And every day we've been reading a different version, a different translation. Been doing this for 3 weeks and still haven't run out of versions to read. And each one of the versions has a heading on this psalm, and God is our my refuge, or God is a safe place. This one is, the heading is, the protection of the Most High. So let me read it to you. The one who lives under the protection of the Most High dwells in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say concerning the Lord, who is my refuge and my fortress, my God in whom I trust. He himself will rescue you from the bird trap, from the destructive plague. He will cover you with his feathers. You will take refuge under his wings. His faithfulness will be a protective shield. You will not fear the terror of the night, the arrow that flies by day, the plague that stalks in darkness, or the pestilence that ravages at noon. Though 1,000 fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, the pestilence will not reach you. You will only see it with your eyes and witness the punishment of the wicked. Because you have made the Lord, my refuge, the Most High, your dwelling place, no harm will come to you. No plague will come near your tent, for he will give his angels orders concerning you to protect you in all your ways. They will support you with their hands so that you will not strike your feet against a stone. You will tread on the lion and the cobra. You will trample the young lion and the serpent. Because he has his heart set on me, I will deliver him. I will protect him because he knows my name. When he calls out to me, I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will rescue him and give him honor. I will satisfy him with a long life and show him my salvation. So you see what I mean when I say that we don't read this in any detached way. We're trusting God for these promises today. We are believing these promises that they will be applied to ourselves and to our family, nations, churches, schools, whatever group we have a heart for and a burden for. We are standing on Psalm 91. And of course, we've said over and over again, this is not justification to do foolish things. That was what the devil tried to tempt Jesus to do. He actually misquoted this psalm and took Jesus to the top of the temple and said, hey, you know, God is with you. Show it. Prove it. Let the people see it. Throw yourself off. And, of course, Jesus refused to do that, saw through the temptation, and quoted a passage back to the devil saying, you shall not tempt the Lord your God. And we're not out tempting him at the same time. We're not living in fear either, that God is with us and he will, as he has promised, to protect us. So anyway, that's how we start. But without further ado, let me bring on our host for today, Janice Kelsey. Janice, welcome to Wake Up to Purpose.
Thank you. A beautiful opening.
Well, thank you, and it's good to have you here. First and foremost, tell our listeners where you live and give us an update on the current status there, what you sense in the mood of the people and the news and what's happening. Just to give us a little overview.
Well, I live in Birmingham, Alabama, and we are under, I'm not trying to be facetious, but we are under house arrest, more or less, a stay in place. And we've had quite a surge in the number of persons who have been hospitalized and quite a number who have died in our county. We're just prayerful, and I'm being prayerful and not fearful of what is going on. We certainly are witnessing the effects of the virus and being cautious. I am in that age and stage and condition where I may be more vulnerable than than the regular population. And so I'm trying to pay special attention to what the county health officials are saying, wearing the mask, wearing gloves, and staying in whenever possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, now you were within your church, and we'll talk more about this, but you were involved in some child care, some educational things within the school. I mean, obviously those have shut down. Are you staying in touch with the families, or just give us a little report on that?
Well, we did have to close our doors. We had an early childhood development program as well as an after-school homework help program. And with the surge of the incidents of COVID-19, we were required by the health department to close our doors. Of course, this affected families where parents had to work. And unfortunately, it affected our ability to operate, because if we can't accept our clients, we don't receive monies to operate. So we are closed, and trusting that we will be able to reopen maybe by the end of May, but it's just a day-to-day thing. We don't know. And, yes, we have been in touch with our parents who are concerned, yet they understand that we cannot and will not subject them or their families to any possible infections. Our building has been sanitized. Our volunteers at the church have worked really hard to make sure that all surfaces have been sanitized. But you just don't know where it is and how it's being communicated. And so we're choosing to obey what the county officials have recommended, and that is we are going to remain closed until told otherwise.
Yeah. Now, that is connected with the church. Tell our listeners about your church and what your relationship to that church is, about the pastor, and talk about the impact to the church ministry. Has it gone online? How do you think people are receiving that? Give us an overview of the church progress, the church ministry as it's going forward today.
Well, I am a member of Greater Shiloh Missionary Baptist Church. My brother, Dr. Michael Wesley Sr., is my pastor. And although we have not allowed public worship since the closure was announced, but we are on Facebook Live on Sunday mornings at 8 o'clock. Following that, we have the Sunday school lesson taught by one of our deacons, who's a very good teacher. Uh-huh. And Tuesdays through Thursdays from 9 until 1, we are offering boxes of non-perishable food items to community members who have a need. And those boxes are prepared. We are in partnership with Christian Service Missions, and it is a very large ministry that collects large quantities of foods from grocery stores and other agencies, and we've been providing those non-perishable items, primarily non-perishable. We do have some items that we are providing fresh fruit and lettuce and items that we have been able to accept, as well as first aid items, Pampers and adult diapers and other kinds of medical supplies that seniors primarily might need. And they are available upon request. We have a team of volunteers who carry the boxes to the car once we are notified that someone is there with a request. And at this point, we have distributed probably over 1,000 food and health items to people in our community. So we are trying to still do mission and do it on the basis that we can. And we are trying to still offer worship, but not with the congregation present. We were offered Holy Communion to people who wanted to drive by the church and pick up the portable communion cups and bread. And we had quite a large participation in that. For the first 2 weeks, it seems that the congregation members have paid their tithes and offering electronically. Some have stopped by the church and left envelopes. So right now the report is good as far as we can do at this point.
But we are
trusting
God
that things will be restored, and I know that it will be. We just have to wait and wait on Him.
Yeah. And I've been by. It's a big church, a significant church, very community church. It's right in the middle of where a whole lot of folks live. So I know it's been a beacon of hope and light, and that hasn't changed. And I knew it wouldn't, and that's good to hear. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Janice Kelsey from Birmingham, Alabama, who is the author of I Woke Up With My Mind on Freedom. And Janice, let's thanks for the update. We've talked about today. Let's go back to the beginning. You are a native of Birmingham, Alabama. Talk to us about what it was like to grow up in Birmingham. And in your book, you set the stage for, you know, what happened, what role you took in high school and beyond. But you know, some of our listeners may be foreign or, you know, out of the country and maybe not be fully aware. So talk to us about the 50s in Birmingham, Alabama, and growing up there.
Birmingham in the 50s and 60s was a very segregated city. In fact, it was said to be the most segregated city in America. There were deep divisions between blacks and whites, and it was pretty much enforced, physically enforced. In fact, there were signs in public places that restricted where you could sit on a bus, whites in the front of the bus, and colored, as we were referred to, were in the back of the bus. Even if seats were available in the front of the bus and none available at the back of the bus, you were required by law to stand. There were signs in public places that restricted which restrooms you could use. They were clearly marked white only, colored only. Water fountains. Restaurants that would serve the black clientele had to have at least an 8-foot partition between the races. The entrances to the restaurant were different. The same thing was true for a movie theater. Although the price you would pay would be the same, could not enter and exit from the same doors, you could not sit and have a meal. There were restrictions in terms of the kinds of jobs you could have. There were no black people who were police officers or public officials. We had at one time a commission or form of government, and there were no black commissioners. Even when we changed originally to a council, mayor council form of government, still there were no representatives of this, of my race, on that city council. Black people were paid less for the same jobs that whites were doing. The schools were segregated. Black kids did not receive the same kind of equipment that the whites received. In fact, in the book, I point out that I didn't really notice or understand why our football team would receive helmets and equipment that was blue and white, but our school colors were green and gray. until it was pointed out to me in a mass meeting that we were receiving equipment from a school that was about 6 or 8 blocks from our school, and their colors were blue and white, but our colors were green and gray. And the kids who played on our football team actually painted the helmets the right colors because they were getting the old equipment when the white schools were getting new equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Textbooks. We would get often outdated textbooks when the white schools received the newer editions. So segregation was everywhere. We did not live in the same communities. We didn't go to the same churches. There, it was just a complete line of separation.
Mm-hmm. And you learned to live with that. I mean, you worshipped in your community. You shopped in your community. Talk about what life was like in the black community in that time.
Well, usually in the community that I grew up in, it was a very close-knit community. And frankly, I was not bothered by the separation because I did not focus on the equalization. I knew the people in my community, in my church, in my school. The families kind of helped each other out. If there was sickness or death in a family, the community would come together and bring food and just take care of the people who were affected. Church, it was close-knit. People took care of those who had less. And so I didn't recognize the inequalities that were really thrust upon me. I didn't like it that I couldn't sit down on the bus and there were vacant seats. I didn't like that. I didn't like it if I bought a hot dog and I couldn't sit down and eat it. But that was the law, and I was born into a society with those laws, and so I obeyed the laws. I didn't think I could do anything about it because that's the way it was. That's the way it had always been.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you're just tuning in, we're talking to Janice Kelsey, the author of I Woke Up With My Mind on Freedom. She's been telling us about her life in the 50s and 60s in Birmingham, Alabama, and a very sad chapter in our country's history. Then you have a chapter in your book that's called My Wake-Up Call. Talk to us about you're living in this situation. You didn't like it, but that's the way it was. You adapted, but suddenly some things started to change, at least in your own perspective and in your own mind. Tell us about that.
Well, during the early 60s, there were mass meetings held at various churches in our communities. And I had a girlfriend whose mother and sister were very active in the mass movement. They sang in the movement's choir. And the movement initially was meeting on Monday nights at different locations. And my girlfriend, who went to the meetings because her mother was going to the meetings, and she would come back the next day and talk about the mass meetings. And so it was conversations that she and I had that perked my interest. She talked about the music and how everybody in the choir had a great voice, and they were clapping and rocking and singing. And at my church, you didn't have to have a great voice to be in the choir. Anybody could join. And she would talk about the crowds, and people would be standing around the walls. And I liked being in a crowd where everybody was. I wanted to be there, too. She talked about how well-dressed the preachers would be in three-piece suits and alligator shoes. And, well, I like well-dressed men. And she talked about cute boys. Oh, the meeting has a lot of cute boys come to these mass meetings. And I thought, yeah, I really do want to go to one of these. And so that was my motivation for going. But when I got there, James Bevel, who was one of the younger preachers, and he held a meeting with all of the teenagers in an adjacent building to the regular mass meetings. And he kind of polled the audience to see who was present. And we had a lot of school pride, and he called our school's name, and we cheered. And after he pretty much assessed who was present, he started asking questions. And it was during that period that I really had an awakening. He started asking things like, at Ullman High School, that was my school, how many electric typewriters do you have? And, you know, an electric typewriter back then was probably like a computer today. Mm-hmm. And he asked, how many electric typewriters did we have? And I thought, well, I'm a great typist, and so I know the answer to that. And I told him, we have one, but I get to type on it. He said, do you know how many they have at Phillips High School? And Phillips High School at that time was an all-white school located in downtown Birmingham. I'd never been in there, so I had no idea. He said, they have 3 rooms of electric typewriters. And I thought, 3 rooms? Wow, that's not fair. He didn't stop there. He went on to ask other questions. Football team, Ullman High School. My brother was with me, and he asked, have you ever wondered why your helmet's always blue and white, but your school colors are green and gray? And my brother went on to explain, we paint them the right colors. We shine up the cleats. Oh, we do a great job with them. He said, yeah, but why do they come in that way? And we didn't know it, the answer. And he said, it's because you're getting the discards from Ramsey High School. Mm. I thought, yikes, Ramsey was just a few blocks from where our school was. And he talked about the textbooks. And he talked about eating a hot dog downtown. How much do you pay for your hot dog? And I thought, about 27 cents. He said, how much you think the people pay for theirs who get to sit down? I thought, surely they paid more. But he said, no, they pay the same thing that you pay. After a series of questions and answers like those, I was convinced that I had been mistreated. And he said, look, if you want to do something about it, you can. Your parents can't, but you can. And he said, you're getting a second-class education. That really struck home with me. Education was always a big deal in our family. Mm-hmm. Everybody had to go to school. My mom expected us to just do our best. And, I mean, the teachers had high expectations. So education was a big thing with me. And he said I was getting a second-class education. And I signed on at that point. Look, I want to do whatever I can to make a difference in this situation. Mm-hmm. And so I joined the movement that night.
Mm-hmm. And where did joining that movement, where did it take you, and how did it express itself in your city?
Well, what it led to for me personally on May 2nd, well, right after that, I started attending meetings that were for young people. Mm-hmm. After school, we had student nonviolent workshops, and we learned some freedom songs. We saw some film clips of demonstrations that had been held in other places, and we were urged over and over again to be sure that the only change that can take place is a nonviolent change. And we were encouraged to remain nonviolent. If you wanted to participate, you had to agree not to fight back and talk back or subject yourself in any way toward a police officer. And we were told when the first opportunity would be available for us to demonstrate. and that was on a Thursday, May 2nd, 1963. And I left school that day and went downtown, went to 16th Street Baptist Church. We gathered inside the church, Reverend Bevel, Andrew Young, Dorothy Cotton. Those were some of the people who were in charge. We sang some freedom songs. They said some prayers. And we marched out singing, "We Shall Overcome." I was subsequently arrested about a block away from the church.
And how old were you?
I was 16 when I was arrested.
Mm-hmm. And so you get a block, and the police stop you. Did you really think there was a possibility you were going to get arrested? Did you think you were bluffing?
Absolutely. I expected to be arrested. In fact, we were told that we would likely be arrested if we participated, and that's why I did not discuss my plans with my mother. I didn't want her to discourage me or, in fact, put a foot down about it. She did caution me before I left home to say, "I'm sending you to school, so don't you go and get yourself in any trouble." And then I said, "Yes, ma'am," because I was going to school. I just wasn't going to stay. So I went, and I left. And in getting ready, prepared to go to jail, I had packed some items in my purse that I would need, you know, toothbrush, toothpaste, and soap, and change of underwear. I felt like I was prepared. In fact, on that morning, walking to school, my girlfriends and I were talking and encouraging each other, "Do you have what you need? Did you pack your bag? Are you ready?" And so we planned to go to jail. So being stopped by the police officer and telling us we would be arrested, that didn't bother me. What did bother me was standing in front of a white man who was wearing a gun and had a stick in his hand. I was feeling some kind of way, a little intimidated by that. Mm-hmm. I mean, somebody started singing "We Are Not Afraid," and that gave me the courage to remain in that line and to be arrested.
Mm-hmm. And so you tell the story in the book, they bust you off. You were in for how long?
I was in for a total of 4 days.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever scared? Were you mistreated at all when you were in?
I was not afraid. Going first to the juvenile facility, that was, we weren't there but just some hours before it became just too packed for any more people to get in there, and they put us on school buses. And from there, we went to the county jail. That was intimidating, going into the county jail, because they took our items that we had prepared for.
Mm-hmm.
They took mug shots and fingerprints, and they interrogated some of us. And so that was intimidating, the intake was.
Sure.
Going into the jail cell where we were, it was like a series, a corridor of jail cells, but we could walk in between them. And it was just like an iron bed without a mattress or anything, and a toilet without any kind of privacy paneling or anything around it. And we sat on the floor, on the concrete floor, and it was cold. But there were so many people there that I knew, and we talked and we sang and we sat on each other when the floor would get too cold. But I was not afraid. We left there after the first night. There were so many others arrested until the county jail was full. So we got on buses again, and they carried us to the state fairground. And it was a little funny going into the state fairground because here again, this was segregated, and they had an amusement park there, but blacks were not allowed to go to the amusement park unless you went on a Saturday night after 10 o'clock, and I had never been. So when the buses turned into Fair Park, we started screaming, Kittyland Park. That's where the Ferris wheel and the carousels and all of this. And I'd passed there many times, so I'd seen it from the outside of the fence. But they didn't let us ride any of the Ferris wheels and stuff. We were put in different places where I was housed. It was a 4-H dormitory, and it had tile floors and restrooms and beds. Some of the beds had mattresses and a sheet. Some of them didn't, but I got one that did. And I was completely satisfied being there. There were some things that occurred that I was not personally affected, but they would call the names of people at night and discharge them. And there was no parent there to receive them. And some things like that did occur. It did not happen to me, but I was aware of that with some other people. And I wasn't aware of where they were going or what they were doing until afterwards when I learned that that's why their names were being called.
Yeah, if you're just tuning in, we're talking to Janice Kelsey, telling her moving story and fascinating story and painful story of segregation, of growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, as told in her book, I Woke Up With My Mind on Freedom. Janice, I know we're jumping around. 4 months after this ordeal of being arrested, you have a chapter that is titled The Unspeakable. Talk to us about that.
Well, after the demonstrations ceased and we were returned to school after being expelled and all, signs came down in the public places, and I thought it was over. I thought we had overcome. President Kennedy had spoken on television about what happened in Birmingham, and I really felt we had won. But on Sunday, September the 15th, a bomb exploded at 16th Street Baptist Church. Now, bombings in Birmingham was not unusual. There were pretty regular bombings that went off in the homes of ministers and lawyers and people like that, but not usually on a Sunday. And so I was at my church, South Ellerton Baptist Church, and our pastor was, he interrupted the person who was speaking at the time and announced that 16th Street Baptist Church had been bombed, and the church just kind of went up in a noisy response, and he dismissed church. And when I got home, I'm from a large family. There were 9 of us. Our phone was ringing and ringing, and people were calling and expressing their condolences to my parents. And when I finally got to understand what it was all about, people were saying they heard that one of the Wesley girls had been killed. And Wesley is my maiden name. And when we got some clarity, we found that, in fact, there were 4 girls who were killed in that bombing. And one of them was Cynthia Wesley. We were not related, but we were friends. I had met her when we were in elementary school, when she was adopted by Gertrude and Claude Wesley, who were friends of my family.
Mm-hmm.
That was the most devastating thing that I think I've ever heard in my life.
Mm-hmm.
I had not known any people in my age group to die, and certainly not to be killed, and to be killed at church. I had a relationship with several of the girls, because one of them, Denise McNair, her father was our milkman.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew her family. She wasn't but 11. I knew my band teacher's daughter, my band teacher in elementary school, Alvin Robinson's daughter. Her name was Carol. She was a ninth grader. She was killed in the bombing. The other little girl, Collins, her sister was in the same class as one of my brothers, and so he knew some of them. I mean, it was just so devastating and painful to hear that kids were killed at church. There were other people who were hurt as well, and there were other people who also died that same day. Two boys on different sections of town were actually killed, one by a police officer and one by two Eagle Scouts who were riding through the black community and shot a kid who was on his brother's bike. So that day in history is forever marked with sadness in my heart and in my head. It just took so much, it seemed to me, to make the changes that occurred. What kind of value did they put on life? And to add insult to injury, those who were responsible for that were not punished, but for many years later. And they were old men by the time they were sent to jail. But I guess when I think about that, it is painful to even recall that it took a very long time before I ever spoke about it out loud. I didn't think anybody wanted to hear it, and I thought maybe they got the wrong girl. So it was kind of survivor's guilt. Just had a lot of mixed emotions about that. And I guess when I finally came to accept it, I thought about the people who were killed don't have a voice. And so I can be that voice to say out loud what I knew, what I saw, how I felt, and hopefully that will bring to the realization of some people the high price that we paid for the freedom that we obtained.
Yeah, and you tell the story very well, and I woke up with my mind on freedom, which is available through Amazon, both Kindle and paper, and there is a link to the radio show description that people can click on, and it will take them right to the site. Janice, we've got about 12-13 minutes, and there's so much, and I always say how much I enjoyed working on the book project with you, but certainly sad to hear the story and to hear what you and so many of your friends and family had to go through. You went on to Miles College. You graduated. You went into education, and you were a pioneer of sorts in the Birmingham Public Schools, probably not of your own choosing. But talk to us about what you found yourself doing in your career as a young teacher.
Well, I taught my first year at a very large elementary school, all black kids, and from a large housing project. And the next year, it was the Board of Education was required to hire a percentage of black teachers into white schools and white teachers into black schools. And I was selected because they handpicked which black teachers would go into the white schools. And I found a lot of differences there. The class size, much smaller, fewer classes. I taught science. I had a well-equipped lab. The school prior to that, there was a lab room, but there was no equipment, not even enough books for every child to have one. So doing homework was not possible or not really feasible because they couldn't take a book home because there weren't enough books for everybody to have one.
Mm-hmm.
I found differences in so many levels that really surprised me that although there weren't signs up anymore, the differences still existed, even
mm-hmm.
in the in how we were paid.
Mm-hmm.
I think after the integration of the staff members, faculty, that they did have to get on the same pay scale. They had to start publishing the pay scales, and it became more balanced in terms of
mm-hmm.
races getting the same monies for the same jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But it always made me, I always wanted to be a teacher. But fairness was always a big thing with me.
Mm-hmm.
When I left the all-white school, it was 7 years I was there. One black student enrolled the year that I left. And I went into West End High School, which had been an all-white school, but it was in transition. It was now about 90% black, and just a few white kids were there. And I was really happy to be back in my community because I felt
mm-hmm.
that some of the best teachers, and I'm not bragging on myself,
mm-hmm.
but we were handpicked to go
mm-hmm.
into the white schools, and that was not the same criteria for the white teachers that went into the black schools. So
mm-hmm.
I felt some kind of way about that as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, you said earlier that, and we've got about 7 or 8 minutes, that you now have come to, you're at peace with telling your story to help people understand the price that was paid for some of the benefits that, not benefits, I mean things, the playing field being a little more equal today than it used to be. Tell us about your involvement, how you're doing that involved the book, but the Civil Rights Institute in Birmingham, and what you're doing today to keep the story alive in a good way.
Well, what I have done, I have remained an activist in terms of civil rights. The sorority that I'm in has a strong stance on equality of races and social action and physical and mental health and things and educational policies and all. And so in that way, I give back. I worked after I retired from the board after 33 years. I worked at the Civil Rights Institute working with underprivileged kids who were undereducated, out of school, and I worked with them to help them get their GED and to make them aware of civil rights issues. I did that for about 2.5 years. And after that, I went to work at my church. And we developed a 501c3 nonprofit. And I've served in administration there in our educational programs, offering a child development program for preschools, well, actually from ages 6 weeks through age 4, and an after-school enrichment and a summer enrichment for elementary kids. And we tend to reach for those who are undereducated, privileged, to expose them to things that they might not otherwise receive in their homes or in their community. I've served on the board of directors at the Civil Rights Institute for a period of time, and I am a lifetime member of NAACP, and I continue to be a member of the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. I'm no longer serving on the board, but I've maintained my family membership there. So I think what I'm doing actively, though, is telling my story, and I've been to many places across the United States sharing primarily with school-age kids and with educators my experience, and hopefully that would provide an awakening or an awareness or increase the awareness of some. And that's what I do on a regular basis now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you do it quite well. And as we wrap up, tell our listeners a little bit about your family. I think you have a son in the ministry, and how's Catrice? Tell us a little bit about family profile today.
Well, I have two adult children. My son is a minister, and he's an independent contractor in computer engineering. But he co-pastors a church in Denver. My daughter works at the church where we are a member. She is an accountant. Between the two of them, I have 5 grandchildren. And and my husband of 40, wow, this will be our 48th year.
Congratulations.
We'll celebrate in July. And he's been very supportive of me in the travels that I've done in sharing my story and even getting me through the sanity of trying to get this book written.
Mm-hmm.
So I still have, there are 8 of us siblings still living. One passed away 2 years ago. But everybody is doing well and very much aware. One brother, Alvin, who was also arrested during the time that I was, spent 5 days in jail. He and I sometimes get to share our stories together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we interviewed some of your siblings for the book, and your sister,
right,
who I believe lives in California,
yes,
told us some things you had never heard. Is that correct?
Absolutely, she did. She shared some things and how she felt about some of what was going on. She didn't share that, I guess, in a sense, like me early on, didn't feel anybody wanted to know. But when prompted, she shared how she felt. And I thought that was pretty significant. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it really is a wonderful project. I woke up with my mind on freedom, the book where you tell your story, and there's so many other interesting things that we don't have time to highlight, but I want to encourage our listeners to either get the book, or they can get in touch with you, can't they, to have you tell your story and come in and keep the legend alive, so to speak.
Absolutely. And my email address, if they wanted to schedule something or get some further information, it's kelseyjwk@aol.com.
Yes, and that's Kelsey, K-E-L-S-E-Y, J-W-K, at AOL.com, or they can write me at johnstanko@gmail. I've had several people contact me since the book's been out to get in touch with you, and, of course, I do that right away. And so glad to do that. Well, I so appreciate our connection, Janice.
I appreciate your work that you are doing in the ministry, and especially with this book and other projects. I do appreciate that, and I've enjoyed working with you.
Yeah, well, that's likewise, and God has made a way for us to get together every year, let's hope once this all lifts that you can take me to another good restaurant in Birmingham. You seem to know where they all are. So
That's one of my favorite pastimes. Great.
Well, it's always great to be with you, Catrice. So thank you for your time. And again,
this
the link to this show will be available. So use it and spread the word, and I will do the same.
I sure will. You have a
all
good
right,
one
thanks.
And be safe. Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Give my love to all your family, and you take care.
All right. Same. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, Janice Kelsey, the author of I Woke Up With My Mind on Freedom. Again, there's so many other interesting stories. This is a human interest story. This is a part of history. Next week, I hope to have one of the sisters of one of the young girls who was killed in the Birmingham bombing. I'm working on that now, so I hope that we can hear more about that. And again, we're trying to keep these stories alive in a good sense. And so I trust that you were moved, as I have been every time I hear the story, and that each one of us will do what we can where we are to contribute to reconciliation today. We can't go back and change the past, but we can learn from the past and make the present better so that the future will even be better than that. So again, I Woke Up With My Mind on Freedom. Access that book on Amazon. Write Janice. Write me to get in touch with Janice, but let's keep the story alive. Well, tomorrow I have Pastor Ron Morrison, another one of our Urban Press authors who is pastor of Christian Missionary Alliance Church in the Cleveland area. He comes to Pittsburgh very often to speak. He published a book last year, but I want to get his – I love Ron. Pastor Ron is a balanced teacher. He's got a lot of insight, a lot of wisdom. So I want to hear from him tomorrow, and I want you to hear from him as well. So join us tomorrow for Pastor Ron Morrison. Until then, this is John Stanko signing off from Wake Up to Purpose, encouraging you to be about the work of purpose in your life. Until tomorrow, so long for now.
Thanks again for listening to Wake Up to Purpose with John Stanko. To get in touch with John, you can go to www.purposequest.com or write him at johnstanko@gmail.com.